Morning and happy Wednesday. The first meeting of the Subcommittee on Child Care Access and Affordability will come to order. I want to welcome everybody. It's very exciting. I'm excited, super excited to have this committee, and I hope that you are too. Child care is an issue that we all understand, and I am so looking forward to a productive bipartisan session. As I've said numerous times around the state and during the task force, that kids are not partisan. And it's for kids, parents, and providers and Minnesota communities that we are here today. When child care thrives and the families with kids in child care thrive, our state thrives. It's really the building block of our community. And since we are a new committee, I'd like to like the members and the staff to please go around the room and introduce themselves. And also, in the spirit of this being a bipartisan committee, I would like you to pick out somebody from the opposite party and say something nice about them.
It's so easy.
Without, like, you know, saying nice hair, but actually dig deep. No, there's only one, right? Well, we can talk about staff, too. You know, I'll go first. Oh, yes, Dave Sullivan. I'm going to say something nice about you. Dave has also did the tours around the state with his DFL members, and so I do appreciate the fact that he took time out of his busy schedule to do those travels and get the input as well so that he can help form with his members ideas of how we can all work together and build child care back up to the thriving business it used to be.
Good morning. I'm Julie Sandstead. I'm from 6A. And I'll say something nice about Tony Albright. As a freshman, Tony was part of an orientation that we went through, and he was very informative.
Morning, Madam Chair. Morning. Tony Albright from District 55B, which is the Prior Lake area, and I have the fortunate circumstances to be sitting next to a freshman representative, Julie Sandstead, and she comes from an education background, so I think she's very well suited to be a very strong advocate for children in this committee.
Well, we might have to say something nice about each other on the Republican side. We're missing some DFL members.
Hi, I'm Roz Peterson. I think we're sitting on a few committees together, so we're going to have to get to know each other a little bit better. And but I am excited to be here, and, of course, I enjoy all my Democrat colleagues, so we'll just leave it open at that. And I represent 56B, which is the Burnsville-Lakeville area.
Good morning. I'm Dwayne Quam. I've got part of Dodge in Olmsted County, and Julie is the most timely and committee ahead of time, member of her caucus, and I will appreciate that so we can actually do our business. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Sunderman. I'm from House Research. I'll be covering this committee, and I generally work on issues relating to child protection and the child care licensing.
Thank you.
Karen Johnson, I'm the CLA and on staff for 10 days.
Welcome.
My name's Bethany Drobiel. I'm the Republican Caucus Researcher for this committee.
David Sullivan with DFL Research, and I can say that you have a wonderful CA for this committee.
Nice.
My name is Laura Larson, and I am the CA, so thank you very much, Dave.
And, you know, I guess I did not introduce myself. I'm Mary Franson. I represent District 8B, so I have the eastern half of Ottertail County and the northeastern part of Douglas County. The biggest city in my district is Alexandria. The motto is easy to get to, hard to leave. In my previous background, prior to being elected, I ran a licensed child care facility. We called it Mary Little Lambs. M-E-R-R-Y, so cute, so fun. And then we had my motto was we practice kindness. And the background behind that was when I started childcare, my youngest was about 18. No, he was a little younger, 11 months, 12 months, somewhere in there. And when I had my other son, Colin, Carl became about 19 months. And he really didn't appreciate having a new baby brother, plus all the other kids in the daycare where he was competing with attention. And so he started, biting kids. He was quite the biter. So we had to, that's, biting is never good for business. Anyway, thankfully he outgrew that. But the saying, we practice kindness, came down. So I wanted to teach the kids, you know, especially my own son, that we can't bully. And so when they did something inappropriate to one another, pushing, hitting, biting, would sit them down and I'd say, what do we practice? And the kids, most of them, except for Carl, would say, we practice kindness. And then my son would say, kindness! Like, oh my gosh, those were the days. So anyway, I will get back to the committee here. In your packets, you're going to find the subcommittee rules, as well as a memo from HHS Reform Chairman Joe Schumacher that directed the creation of our subcommittee, which I am extremely grateful for. Subcommittees by nature operate just a tad bit little differently. HHS reform essentially serves as an umbrella committee that decides what bills to send us for consideration. Bills, however, never formally leave the jurisdiction of that committee and can only be unofficially amended by us for consideration of Health and Human Services reform, which I also serve on. If you have any additional questions about how subcommittees operate, please let my committee administrator, Laura Larson, no. So now, we have Representative Kreisha has joined the building. Representative Kreisha, if you would please introduce yourself, let us know where you represent, and pick a member and say something nice about them.
We're all on pins and needles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kreisha, and I'm actually going to pick Julie, because I had the opportunity to meet her in the new member orientation, and I had some nice conversations and really enjoyed the time. So I'd pick Tony, but, well, you know.
We know.
We have this thing.
Yeah.
And
thank
so you represent where?
I represent Morrison. Little Falls is the town right in the center of my district between St. Cloud and Brainerd. So.
Fabulous. Thank you. All right. So we are now going to move to a presentation by DHS about the Child Care and Development Block Grant. I believe that Commissioner Jim Koppel is in the room. Yes, there you are, right in front of me. And then we have Regina Wagner. And I'm just going to ask that you guys come up to the front. The Child Care Block Grant is basically a federal mandate. And so there are some things that we need to comply with so right now I believe that we are in some waiver. We are being waivered currently. So I've asked the department to give us an overview of that. Hopefully you'll let us know how many FTEs, how much it's going to cost to implement, all that good stuff as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner. Sorry.
Madam Chair, just for the sake of the testifiers committee, would you prefer that we hold all questions until after the presentation or
yes.
during?
So this is a pretty in-depth overview, and so it may take us the next committee next week to finish. So I don't want the committee members or those in the crowd to feel like we need to rush through today, because this is pretty deep. There's going to be a lot of questions. But so we're going to ask the department to go over. If there are questions, please write them down. Members may get that to them today. It may be next week, so you may have to hold on to that. If there are individuals that came to testify today, we can have them come up and give testimony, but don't feel that today is the only day we're going to be discussing this. Okay? Commissioner Koppel, welcome.
Thanks again, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Children and Families Administration in the Department of Human Services, look forward to, I don't know if I'm supposed to say something nice about someone, but I'll say something nice It's certainly been pleasure to know that the focus has it's increasingly shifting to early childhood. It's such an important time in a child's life and their development, and I'm really encouraged that the subcommittee will be spending its time moving that forward. So I appreciate all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, I do want to say there's a couple things in your packet that we weren't going to cover today, but we could talk about a little bit, and that's an overview, a quick overview of the child care assistance program that we operate and which the federal block grant supports. There is a packet with short presentation on the child care assistance program. It looks like this. It's a two-pager. I don't know if this got to you or not.
No.
Does it look familiar?
No, we do not have that.
Okay. So I think we sent, I don't know. Laura, did you? Oh, okay. It wasn't. They're coming. Okay.
We have it now.
I think it's coming in. I just wanted to call attention to it because it maybe I'll spend a minute on it just so the new members and others new to the committee can get a glimpse of what it looks like. And also, there's a one pager on the impact that the block grant has on providers, and that's another. Some of the changes and regulations, and that's another one that you'll either do have or will have. You do have that one. Okay, great.
We're not as fortunate as you are.
I'll you can have my copy, Representative. So on the child care assistance program, the one that you're getting right now, who do we serve? You can see that we serve about 30,000 children, 16,000 families. Now, there are two child care programs, just so you clear on that. There is that TANF, or MFIP, our TANF program in Minnesota is called Minnesota Family Investment Program, and the MFIP, our welfare program, is forecasted, which means that everybody who's eligible for child care on MFIP gets it. Okay, so that's not it's not capped. There's no waiting list. Everybody on that program that needs child care, whether they're working part-time or they're going to school, they get child care. The CCAP program serves those families which are working and are no longer on child care assistance or on MFIP. They're out working and they need child care. That's the one where there's a waiting list and what it will talk about for the most part. But both programs, but all those families on all those child care programs get the same reimbursement in terms of their providers that they use, get the same reimbursement. They operate under that same scheme. Just trying to give you a little overview of that. So the first page just shows the population, more or less, of who we serve. Majority of the kids are between 0 and 5. Race and ethnicity, pretty self-explanatory. Second page, what type of child care do they use? So there are four categories. The largest is licensed centers. 64% of the child care is used as licensed centers. Second is licensed families. And then you have two exempt areas, the licensed exempt centers. Those are centers who are legally exempt from needing to be licensed. And the same is true with the legal non-licensed. Those are generally family child care. So those are the four broad areas of providers. when we look at the Parent Aware program, which is our quality rating system, the next slide or picture there is the percent of children receiving child care assistance in a high quality setting. So these are 3 or 4 star rated settings. I personally think that we could have shown, and I'll say verbally, any provider that's in Parent Aware to me is a quality provider and a high quality provider. But this is just to show the growth in the 3 and 4 star rated programs. In 2012 and 2013, we just had Parent Aware. We didn't have the 3 and 1, 2, 3, 4 star. So that's why those all looked the same color. Then in 2014 and up to date, we have seen that increase across the state in 3 and 4 star. Two things to mention about 3 and 4 star rated programs is, one, they're eligible for scholarships, which come through the Department of Education, but there's Early Childhood Scholarship Program. As of July 1st last year, only 3 and 4 star rated programs can serve children with scholarships. So that's a big opening in terms of a business plan. And then also for reimbursement under CCAP, under child care assistance, 3 and 4 star rated programs get more money. If you're a 3 star rated, you get a 15% additional increase in your reimbursement. And if you're a 4 star, you get 20. So there's significant advantages to being a 3 or 4 star rated Parent Aware. The total number in 2016, for instance, of providers who are in Parent Aware serving CCAP children is just under 40%. So that 33% are the 3 and 4, but there's additional nearly, I think about 6%, 39% total that are 1 or 2 star. The next page, funding for 2016 was $249 million, $150 million, including federal state funding for MFIP child care, $98 million, including federal, state, and county funding for basic sliding fee child care. So the basic sliding fee, I should have been clear on what I said earlier. So the basic sliding fee program is this program that serves working families. The MFIP child care is the program that serves families on MFIP. And you can see just about the same number of children varies year to year are on each of the programs. And as the last thing at the bottom, there are 5,400 families on a waiting list for the basic sliding fee child care program, which I mentioned earlier is capped funding. So when counties spend their allocation or get close, they quit taking families, and those families go on a waiting list. That number varies all the time. It can be as high as 7,000. It sometimes gets down around 5,000. The thing I would say about it is this. There are about 14,000 to 15,000 families eligible for the basic sliding fee program that are not on it. Of those families, these are families who have gone through the process, are eligible, and are waiting. If we, and actually Governor Carlson back in the 90s, actually funded the waiting list. He put a lot of money into child care, and he funded the waiting list. It lasted about 2 months, and then there was a waiting list. So in other words, there's more demand than this waiting list is. It's just indicative of the fact. I always say if you were at a restaurant and there was a three-hour wait, you might not put your name down. But if that wait went away, you might put your name down. And it's kind of like that for child care. Okay, so that's just a brief overview of child care. Madam Chair?
Yeah, actually, Commissioner Koppel, we have the funding for currently who we are already serving. Could you just give us a number of what we're looking at for right now, the families that are officially waiting, the 5,400 families? Do you have those numbers?
Madam Chair, just to be clear, you're wondering, like, if we were to pay for those families to fund that waiting list, let's
yes.
say, hypothetically, about 5,000 families. I know last year we attempted, you know, to look at that. If I'm not mistaken, and this is not official, I think I see my staff up there all grimacing whenever I do this, you know, because it's dangerous. I am dangerous, I admit it. But
you're on record, by the way.
theoretically dangerous, let me clarify. I want to say we pay about $10,000 or $11,000 a year per family. It's the cost, you know, in the basic lighting fee. So if we did that times 5,000 times 10,000 is 50 million, or anyway, we'll get it to you. I'm sorry.
And that's just for 1 year.
That's per year. Yeah, it's expensive. You know, as we all know, any of us that have used childcare over the years, it was expensive, and it is expensive, yeah. and so the program is costly. So with that, I will move toward the PowerPoint that you have up on the screen, and we can start going through that. So in terms of background, the Child Care Development Block Grant is the federal child care development grant that initiates a number of things. It pays for child care assistance. It creates and assures that there's quality system, a quality improvement system for child care, and we have ours is the Parent Aware program. It also assures health and safety, which is the licensing portion of child care. So it's fairly comprehensive in what it funds, but also how it states should regulate. In November 2014, the child care block grant was reauthorized for the first time since 1996. And in the reauthorization, following that, there were draft rules that went out. Those rules are now final. And so what we're talking about here is, you know, a very clear picture in terms of what Congress and administration has created for us. I would also just say this. The last time, and this is just for context again, following the 1996 block grant reauthorization, and this was during the time of the administration and second term of Governor Carlson, just to give you some context, we were paying providers, 75% of providers at, they were receiving their full costs, their cost of business. The reimbursement covered 75% of providers' rates, of all providers. Today, it's closer to 25%. So we've seen a change there, and I'll explain it in a minute. And then secondly, in terms of the entry rate and exit rate on child care, we're pretty close to where we were then. The difference is now we use state median income. Then they use the poverty guidelines, so we're comparing two different measures. But without going into any specific detail, it's pretty close to what it was in that time. And then I think the last thing that really is important to realize is in 2003, we were serving 22,000, almost 23,000 families in the basic sliding fee program. Today, we're serving 15,000. So there's been a drop. What happened in explaining that in 2003, 2005, the state was faced with big deficits, and these were part of how we balanced the budget. And so a lot of money came out of child care. A lot of money went into child care in the late 90s under Governor Carlson. A lot of money came out of child care
in the early 2000s, as I mentioned, under Governor Plenty, because we were in different economic places. No judgment on those except to say the program's taken some major hits, and we haven't really made up for those in the years that have transpired. Okay, so now the focus of the reauthorization is family provider-friendly eligibility policies, and these are the things that we're going to cover today and if we need to continue. But these are broad policies that will impact and improve the program.
Yes. I'm just going to ask members right now before we move on to the policies if anybody has any quick questions right now for the commissioner. Okay, seeing none. Oh, Representative Peterson, or Vice Chair Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if you have this information, but since we might be reconvening on this, I'm just wondering if you have any demographic breakdowns of children served in Greater Minnesota versus the metro area.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, yeah, I'm sure we do, and I can get those for you in terms of breakout because the program is county administered, and you know we do know by county, so we have all of that breakout information, and I'd be happy to get it for you.
And then, Madam Chair, I'm also wondering if there's any. A lot of these child care programs are based on full time. Do you have part time options as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, yes, we do. There are daily rates for child care. There are weekly rates. I even believe there are hourly rates. So you can have your child in. That's part of the process is when you apply, part of your application is how much child care do you need. And so it's all taken in at that time.
Continue.
Madam Chair, thank you. And then I'm just wondering if you know what kind of supports are available for parents who are that they could incorporate at home, particularly for those that might be on the waiting list, because a lot of what happens in Parent Aware are different strategies, different learning models, and if there is an opportunity to provide some of those resources to parents in a different form.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I think that's a great question, and I would suggest that we probably don't do it directly through the child care program, but through early childhood education, ECFE, where we try to encourage parents to come and new parents and share experiences and learn developmental tools. And so there are avenues for that. There was at one time, back in the day, I don't know if members that remember, trying to remember the representative's name from Marshall, doctor, Representative Mulder, who introduced at-home child care. And so he also had an option where you could, upon having a baby, actually receive a percentage of a CCAP or child care reimbursement rate to stay at home with your child. And I don't know if there was any educational materials connected to that, but he was in an attempt to try to have another option in that regard. And that policy actually is still on the books, but it's not funded anymore. So part of the problem is resources. So when you put resources somewhere and you already have a waiting list, you run into all those competitive issues.
All right. Next up, we have Representative Cagle. And then if you just want to tell a little bit about yourself since you came in a little later.
Sure.
And then find something nice to say about another member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name's Erin Cagle. I'm from Blaine Coon Rapids Spring Lake Park, freshman this year. So, and kind of some of my interest in this, I've been working in a community action setting where we have a lot of we do early Head Start and Head Start programming. And so my question is, what qualifies a setting as a high quality setting? And then how do the settings earn the 3 and 4 star ratings? Oh, and the something nice. I like that necklace.
uh,
Commissioner Koppel.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Cagle. I would, if it's okay, I can get you that information, and because I think what we want to try to cover first today is to give you a good idea of what the changes are as a result of the reauthorization of the block grant.
Mm-hmm.
And
parent aware is a whole different topic.
And the only connection that we will talk about later is the fact that the amount of money in the block grant, the percent of money that we spend on quality has increased. The reauthorization tells states you need to put more of this money into quality than you are now. We're putting like 3 to 4% in. I think this asks us to go to 11% and then higher after that, by 1%. What it's emphasizing, the only point I would make on that is it's emphasizing that we continue to improve quality of child care, early childhood programming. That quality is parent aware for us. That's the program. Every state has a quality system. They all are different names. That's what ours is called. So I'd be happy to talk about how you get into parent aware and qualify and then move up through those ratings 1, 2, 3, and 4. But I would prefer that if I could get you that information, or we could meet with you and review it with you.
Okay.
So we could stick to this. Is that okay with you, Madam Chair?
That's excellent. Thank you, Commissioner Koppel. And then also we have Representative Flanagan here, and she is our DFL lead, and I'll let her introduce herself and say something nice.
Hi, I'm Peggy Flanagan. I'm the state rep from 46A, which is St. Louis Park, Golden Valley, Plymouth, and Medicine Lake. My sort of connection and background to this, I'm the former executive director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, where we worked on this issue quite a bit. My family also used the CCAP program when I was coming up, and so know that it can be helpful in lifting families out of poverty. And something nice is that I hate to like Representative Cresha, but I do. So, hats out of the bag.
I love it. All right, Commissioner Koppel, go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have an answer to your earlier question, that if all of those, all of that waiting list was to be funded, and all of those people on that waiting list were still eligible, because sometimes circumstances change or they found other child care or they've done other things. But let's just assume for this that we just funded those 5,000, I believe it was 5,600, approximately $84 million a year. Some of those families may have more than one child in child care. When you fund a family, when a family becomes eligible, you, all of their children. It could be two young children and one school age, and they all need child care, one after school and the other two full-time. You're not sure family to family, but there's a general fiscal note approach we take, you know, so we assign an amount to each, and that's what it would cost. So the four key areas, again, that we'll cover: family and provider-friendly eligibility policies, updated reimbursement rates, transparent consumer and provider education information, and health and safety requirements for child care providers. Those are the four we chose to format it this way, but that's the four major areas of the reauthorization. So the first one, the family-friendly eligibility policies, pretty simple slide there. We are moving from a six-month eligibility redetermination to a 12-month eligibility redetermination. This is very good in a couple of ways. So when a family submits at the beginning of their eligibility verifications, and they're eligible, for a year. Right now, we ask those families to come in at 6 months for recertification, which could change their co-pays, could change their eligibility, could change their hours. And when you're working and there's a change in status with your child care, anybody, again, who's experienced this knows it's alarming. And so, and it also doesn't serve the provider well, because the provider may fall victim to this at any given time. If the copays go up, or if the hours change, or the person becomes ineligible, their market changes. And they don't have a big market in most cases, especially family child care. They have a limited number of families and number of kids, and so it has a big impact. Going from 6 to 12 months stabilizes that whole process. Continuous eligibility. So within this 12-month period for families, things that it addresses, this shows you MFIP child care family going to transition year child care, which is also funded. And so that, and then to go to, not necessarily, you can come on the basic sliding fee. You don't need to be on MFIP and transition year in order to be on the basic sliding fee program. You can just come in, and if you're eligible at an income level. But the flow between these is not always smooth, and this smoothed it. So this allows continuous child care for 12 months for family if they're transitioning between these programs. If you're on the program, you're on for 12 months. If you move from MFIP to your transition year and then you move off of that sooner than a year, you're going to get child care for a year, regardless of what category you're fitting in. Currently there's a 3 months of, you need to be on MFIP for 3 months in order to be eligible for a transition year. This eliminates that 3 month, and reduces it to 1 month. So you don't, you know, again, this is moving us away from dependency on a program. You don't need to stay on a welfare program for 3 months in order to get eligible for another program that actually is a work support. You only need to be on 1 month, and you can go right into a work support program. If you get a job or you can move off, this helps you do that. It does bring up one last thing I'll mention here that is maybe obvious to you, but child care sliding fee, any child care program, is a perfect example of a two-generation approach to supporting a family, because it's an early childhood development program for the kids, and it's a work support for the parents. So when you are doing it well and you have this stability of eligibility, stability of costs, stability of providers, and the high quality, and the child is developing well and is getting ready for school, and the parents are able to work continuously, it's a win-win all the way across the family. And this is a really unique example, because we don't have a lot of programs that serve two generations. We tend to kind of focus on one or the other. Okay, reporting requirements. States must limit reporting requirements between redeterminations to items that impact eligibility or items needed to contact a family or pay providers. So what we're trying to do here, we have a very complicated child care program. Counties administer it. It's not their favorite program. There's lots of rules, lots of detail. Chair Franz is very familiar with all the complications, not just that arise at the county level, but the confusion that sometimes it causes and how programs are implemented county to county and how things are carried out. So this really simplifies the program. For instance, once you're eligible, you go on for 12 months, you are required to, the families are required to report changes, major changes in income, but not minor, not hour changes at work. Now, all the things that we used to monthly say, you have to come in and tell us all the time, you don't need to do that anymore. So if your income goes over 85% of the state median income, which is $65,767 for a family of three, then you need to report it, because that's the federal allowance. That's as high as the feds say you can go. Then you have to report it. If you're under that, you don't need to report it, and you settle up at your 12-month redetermination. You know, then you come in for the next year, and all of that gets sorted out a new copay, et cetera. I thought maybe you had your, maybe not, like, hand up. There are specific situations such as work ending or school ending that
Commissioner
would
Koppel,
also. Yes.
Is your family of three, is that like broke down by parents and one child, or is that three children, or?
That's on page 8.
Yeah. Right. I think it's just a parent, two children, or? It could be either one. It's a family. It's three people with adding, you know, that's the state median income for a family of three. And it, so median income, obviously, is 50% above, 50% below. So the next area we'll cover is copays and graduated phase-out. Copays do not increase during the 12-month period. So if your income goes up during this time, your copays don't. If your income goes down, you can go in and get your copays adjusted. But as long as your income stays under that 85th percent of state median income, you stay on the program and your copays don't go up. Right now, as you can see, the family of three, in order to be eligible for the program, you need to be under 47% of the state median income. Your exit level is 67% of the state median income. That's still true, but not within that 12-month period. If your income goes above that 67th percentile, but below the 85th, you remain on the program for that 12-month period until you come back up, and then you would lose your eligibility if you're above the 67th percentile. Is that clear? Okay. So some of the things that we like about the federal requirement, there's fewer decreases in the amount of care authorized, so it's steady authorization. Parents can count on, providers can count on, consistent use of their child care. It's a steady schedule. Employment requirements continue. So if your employment fluctuates, you're working 30 hours one week and 25 the next, your child care continues if the work hours decrease. So it doesn't make you continually adjust back and forth and go back in and try to get more hours, et cetera. Temporary changes, medical leave, school breaks, seasonal work, that's allowed for. Extended eligibility, 3 months of care when work or school ends. So it allows a transition off for 3 months. It's not a one-month transition. These are all requirements under the federal legislation, either in the statute or in the regs. And again, the main purpose of this, if you look at it from just a child development as well as a work support, is these children are in a consistent place. They have a consistent caregiver, and you don't want to break that pattern up. Children don't do well in transitions. And so the fewer transitions we can make during that 12-month period, the better. And that's what this is realizing. It's a healthy child development environment we're creating, as well as a consistent work support. Homeless families, very specifically, were addressed. The application process within 5 working days, and then you have 3 months to follow up to verify what you do in 5 days. So you kind of you try to process a family in as quick as possible and get their children into child care, and then you follow up and get more detail on the parent or parents after that. And they have up to 3 months to find work, start school, or start up an employment plan. So it's the same process where you get them in right away, you work with the family for 3 months to verify everything, as well as get them moving toward the activities they need to in order to continue child care. Reimbursement rates. This sets maximum rates based on the most recent market rate survey. Okay, so we do market rate surveys every 2 years. We may or may not adjust to those market surveys. It depends on what the legislature appropriates to the program, how much money is available. This says that we must set our reimbursement rates on the most recent market rate survey. There was a survey done in 2016, a market rate survey in 2016. Here's my difficulty, Madam Chair and members, in trying to give you fiscal impacts. We had a bill last year that was pretty a larger bill that had the reauthorization pieces in it, but it also had provider rates being paid at the 50th percentile, not the 25th percentile. So it was set up differently, and it was a lot of money. It was up over $200 million for the binium. And I could give you those costs, but the costs and whether or not, because we are awaiting governor's budget in another couple of weeks, and we don't know what's in that governor's budget, I'm a little constrained in terms of giving you the exacts. I can give you a ballpark of some of these. But the by doing a most recent, tagging it to a more recent survey and having to do that won't bring providers above the 25th percentile. You know, it's not going to increase them above that. But it will basically say they're going to get paid at that the same amount, but it's based on the most recent survey, which will increase their rates because it moves everybody. The market rate is like inflation. It increases, the rates are going to increase. So let me again try to give you a clear definition of what that 25th percentile is. 25% of providers, in some cases more than 25%, I'll explain in a second, get their rates. What the rates are for those providers they get. Additionally, as these have been set and updated, if your rates as a result of a survey actually go down, because in your particular area there might be a decrease in the cost of child care, you get to maintain your rate. In other words, your rates never go down as a result of these updates. They can only go up. So some child care providers above that 25th percentile are also being paid above the 25th. So there's more providers in that 25th percentile.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, are there examples of where rates have gone down? Because I really hadn't seen, and if that's a regional effect in the state, it might be useful for the committee to have a couple of maps of the state, one having what the rates are in the areas, and the other having, you mentioned, you know, 3- and 4-star, you know, by county availability, you know, percent of mm-hmm. of providers or whatever is a easy tool, and something that shows the programs, because you mentioned there's certain programs, and now it only goes to 3- and 4-star, where those program families are. That way we can understand the dynamics across the state mm-hmm. and be able to reference it, and it might help us to understand issues, you know, in the different areas.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, that was a great suggestion. We can map that out and bring all that information. And I do think it does give you a good idea of where things are as a state. You know, urban, rural, as well as centers and families and scholarships versus child care, et cetera. Because it's, I would also add, again, when I say we have a complicated child care program, it's not, I'm not sugarcoating it. We have, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I think we have 2,000 potential rates that we pay. So I'm not going to get into that level of detail, but it's just an example of from all the different providers, all the different types of providers, licensed, exempt, legally unlicensed, family, centers, three-star, four-star, and by the various economic region, you know, most recent surveys, updated. Some, I'm not suggesting there's a lot of providers who are grandparented in to the 25th percentile because their rates have gone down. Be very slight if they have, you know, it's not like they're getting the 55th percentile. But in some cases, there are been, over time, there have been changes that we've made. So I will get all that as much as possible for the next time or pass it along if there's not an additional opportunity.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. And then Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Koppel, and I'm going to tag on what Representative Quam said in terms of the demographics. I just want to revert back to your description of the survey set. And when you set rates, my first question is relevant to how do you determine the sampling or the survey set that ascribes to the min-max for the rates themselves? If you could just overview, provide that to me or to the committee at a later date if it's not something that you want to just jump into the corn on right now. I do have a follow-up as well, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Albright. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I believe we can get all. I can get you that information. I don't, you know, have the survey detail. I know we do a fairly large survey, but I can get you that detail and present it, or just give an information one pager to the committee, whatever's easiest.
Madam Chair, the reason for the question is more to the point of, you know, as you look at this chart in terms of the types of child care facilities, I guess I'm making a supposition that if you are a licensed child care center,
mm-hmm.
your scale of economy in comparison to a family-owned center in greater Minnesota is going to be diametrically opposed to one another. And so as we look at rates, and to your point about potentially 2,000 different rates, I'm just wondering if we are disadvantaging one provider network, and I'll just, you know, lay this out there, to the detriment of the family child care centers, but to the benefit or to the advantage of the child care centers by virtue of their scales of economy when you set rates. And I'm just wondering if at some point we might talk about if there's maybe an opportunity for a two-tier situational for those rates that doesn't disadvantage one group against the other in terms of when a family has to decide as opposed to the vicinity and the demographics that they want to endear their children to. So maybe for further conversation, Madam Chair.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Albright. Commissioner Koppel, would you be willing, perhaps your department could maybe in layman's term type of, like, explain this whole 25 percentile deal? And are you saying now we don't need to conform to the 50th percentile as long as we are setting the maximum rates at the most recent market survey?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
So we're talking about maintaining from a federal minimum, you know, or what they are asking is that whatever the state is paying, whatever percentile we're at, it has to be based on the most recent market survey. So if we were at the 50th, we'd have to pay the 50th at the most recent. If we're where we are at the 25th, we have to pay at the most recent survey.
Has that market survey been done yet?
Madam Chair, yes, it has.
Okay.
2016. There was a market survey.
All right. And do we have the access to that information?
Do we?
Can we get that for next week?
Madam Chair, yes.
Sure.
And we can add that information. And that might help with some of what Representative Albright was asking, too, in terms of the details.
Yes. And then one more question. Is that broken down to counties as well?
Madam Chair, I believe it's...
Or areas? Regions.
It's not county. Is that correct, or do we have it by county? I thought we used to do it by county, and then we moved to region.
Regions, okay.
Region?
We should be able to.
Oh,
you're dangerous.
Upon thinking about it, we can do both.
Fabulous. Thank you. Okay, carry on, Commissioner.
Members, on a payment timeline, currently the time frame for receipt of payment is 30 days. The new time frame would be 21 days. And this has been, again, in some counties, an issue, reimbursement, timeliness of reimbursement for providers. So, Madam Chair, as we get into consumer and provider education, yes.
Commissioner Koppel, the payment time frame, I was under the impression that the block grant was like 3 or 5 days that we had to pay it. I thought we had talked about that in the task force.
I don't believe,
no?
Madam Chair, no. 21 days was and is, you know, that was the draft, I believe, in the draft regulation and now in the final, and so it was
21 days.
21 days, 3 weeks. Okay. Madam Chair, as we get into the consumer provider education, there's a little bit of overlap, and I'm going to hand it off to Ms. Wagner, who's the acting director of our Office of Inspector General. And as you know, Mr. Kerber retired last fall, Ms. Wagner has stepped in to fill those shoes.
I'll be needing that cell phone number like I had Jerry's.
Yes, there's many legendary stories to share. But as we talk about the consumer and provider education piece, I just want to say that what we're trying to do is develop through websites the opportunity for parents to look at websites and see quality or issues with providers, as well as providers to go to websites and find information about trainings or other things. So this IT side is expanding, and we have a lot of work to do, and we are doing around that. So some of this will overlap both on the licensure side but on the family side and on the provider side. But we'll, if it pops up and we both need to talk, we might. Otherwise, I think Ms. Wagner will be able to present the changes that are both in consumer provider education and in the health and safety requirements.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reggie Wagner, and I am the division director for the licensing division and the interim inspector general. Representative Friends, and I do want to, in terms of following the protocol and saying something nice, I do want to thank you and many of your subcommittee members for the work over the last year and a half on the hearings around the state that you held and so many of you went to. We had representatives from the department that were attending all of those hearings. I want to let you know that we learned a great deal. We had good conversations both within the licensing area as well as within the Children and Family Services area around issues related to rates, to licensing issues. So it was very, very helpful. It gave us a lot of information that we don't always get directly from a range of providers. And so I just want to let you know that both that and the task force has been very helpful in generating some good conversations internally and helping us to better inform our work. What I'd like to just maybe do is to, just as a quick overview, draw your attention to this one pager that you have, because as I talk a little bit, I think if I give you a few a high-level licensing 101, it might help to put a context for those of you that might be a little less familiar. So the Department of Human Services, we license several different types of services, chemical dependency treatment centers, you know, what had historically been called group homes for people with disabilities, services that are delivered in some unlicensed settings as well because they're on waivers. And we also do child care. The child care is overseen in two ways. One is what we call directly licensed child care centers. And as you can see on this table, we have center-based licensed child care centers. And the staff at the Department of Human Services, as licensors, directly go out and monitor and oversee those. Then we have what we call a delegated system or indirectly licensed, where the statute in the Human Services Licensing Act 245A has delegated statutorily to the counties certain licensing functions. And the commissioner, through the licensing division, has oversight of that work. So for family child care, which would be the last box on the right that I'm talking about directly on that chart on the upper line, the licensed family child care, the bulk of that licensing application work, monitoring, inspections, reviews, is done through counties and through their licensing staff that the counties have. What might help you to understand on this chart is we have been through our work here, been talking about the maybe like the four categories in which we're talking about licensing child care. Licensed centers, licensed family child care providers, and then we have our legal non-licensed, generally done in-home, and our license-exempt centers. Under the Human Services Licensing Act, it describes and defines who needs a license and who doesn't. There are 27 exemptions from licensure in the Human Services Licensing Act. Of those, 13 involve the care of a child. So a range of different settings. Could be the ECFE thing. Could be if the, you know, parent is there at the health club, lifetime fitness sort of thing. The numbers that you see here do not represent all of the legally non-licensed or the license exempt. They represent those that are participating in the child care assistance program. The idea is that if you are exempt from licensure, then we wouldn't necessarily know that you're out there because you don't need a license. If we are alerted to a situation and we, either us or at the county level, go out and do a review and determine that, no, this is the type of thing that needs a license, then we would let the individual or entity know that, get them connected as fast as we can to licensure. So in Minnesota, particularly for a family setting, you do not need a license if you are providing care for up to one unrelated family. So you could have your own children and, say, a neighbor's child. You do not need a license to do that. If you were participating in the child care assistance program for that neighbor family, you would show up on our chart as one of those known numbers. If you are wanting to care for not only your own child and your neighbors, but now your neighbor across the street, you would need a license. And then you would show up under our licensed family child care. So I just want to be certain for those of you who are a little less familiar to understand that the license, legal non-license and license-exempt centers are a subset of whoever may be out there in accordance with our exemptions providing care, but we know them and we know these numbers because they're participating in the child care assistance program, and they would be impacted by these changes that both Assistant Commissioner Koppel talked about and then I will be talking about.
Ms. Wagner, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Representative Albright has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wagner, I'm looking at a very colorful chart. First question is, where would nonprofits or 501c3 religiously oriented organizations, where would they fall in this matrix?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, they could fall under the licensed child care center. They could fall potentially under the license exempt. Again, it really depends on the scope of what they're doing. If they're just doing limited before and after school, they may not need a license. If they're doing a sort of a full-time preschool, they generally would need a license. So it isn't limited to the type of entity. It's the activity and scope of the type of care that you are providing.
Madam Chair, just as a follow-on to that, the scope of activity, but is also relevant to the number of children in their care?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, for an individual, the answer would be yes if it's one unrelated family. So that would go, I guess, for an entity, too. I mean, if as soon as they start to say we want to be able to serve, you know, people in the neighborhood, then that would automatically put them into one unrelated family. They would need a license. But the scope between if you're doing it in your own home, there's a few exceptions for still being kind of a group family care versus a larger setting and capacity. Family child care, you generally can't exceed 14 for a capacity. So above 14 could put you then into the center category.
Madam Chair, just one final question. Under the legal non-licensed relative only, and I note that there is a proposed change for the Minnesota and FBI background study request, is that only for the provider or for individuals living in the home as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I believe it will impact the people in the home. When we get to that slide, I may have that right in front of me, and if not, then we'll follow up with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, regarding the consumer and provider education, as Mr. Koppel indicated, this is meant to provide both families and providers with access to very helpful, broad information. The intent is that families can go online and understand how a child care center is regulated. They can get provider-specific information that they can then make choices about. And they can understand who needs a background study, what that involves, and then also that they could find access to other state programs that they might need. So the idea is that that it's a kind of a one-stop portal. The website that currently the department is sort of saying is our one-stop portal, and we continue to kind of revise and revamp that, is parentaware.org. That is a DHS website. And it has information that allows parents to access both some provider specifics, demographics, hours of location. It links with our licensing database, so it provides information around capacities and hours. And it also allows the public and the family to click on a link and be able to go to the compliance history, which is sort of our licensing database. Some of that information will be changing as we seek to come into compliance with the federal reauthorization.
And Ms. Wagner, I'm just going to ask the members here. Commissioner Koppel has to leave in 2 minutes.
What time is it? I'm glad you mentioned it, Madam Chair. I would have been late.
I mean, I'm looking out for you.
Thank you.
That's what child care providers do, right? So anyway, do any members have any questions for Commissioner Koppel? All right, seeing none. Commissioner Koppel, you will be back next Wednesday, correct?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to, and I'll have no time constraints.
Okay, fabulous. We will hold you to that. Thank you for coming in today. Ms. Wagner?
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'd like to do then is just touch briefly on some of the health and safety. Generally, what the Reauthorization Act of 2014 did was probably very more deliberately begin to link health and safety licensing standards in with early childhood development and ensuring that children in early child care settings are being regulated when child care assistance dollars are helping that family to access the provider, and that there is a common framework across the country rather than individual state policies. The key elements that we would call out in looking at health and safety are a requirement for annual inspections and monitoring, minimum health and safety standards and training, and then the background study requirements. So for the annual inspections and monitoring, This will be a very big change for licensing, both for us with centers as well as the county work. Currently, we seek to get out on an every 2 year schedule just for regular monitoring inspections. We obviously go out when needed to respond to allegations of abuse or neglect, maltreatment. The county does that as well for family child care settings. They are responsible for the maltreatment work that's done there. If there is a licensing complaint that is called in and warrants sort of an immediate response. So those types of triage happen whenever they need to and continue to happen. The regular, haven't had a call, don't need to go out and see this person, how often am I getting out there to just monitor them? Generally for centers, we try to stay on a two-year schedule, and the county's generally go through a two-year licensing cycle, and so most family child care providers are being seen 2 years. The license-exempt centers and the legal non-license are not currently inspected. They do, and we'll get into a little bit, some currently have some background study requirements, some don't, so even that's going to shift a little bit, but generally there isn't an inspection requirement under the reauthorization changes. If they're participating in the child care assistance program, then they will be subject to some inspection. Requires state – I'm sorry, Madam Chair?
Yes, actually, I do have a question about unlicensed. This has come up numerous times to me. Let's pretend I am a unlicensed child care provider. I do care for many families unlicensed. Who has the authority to shut that unlicensed business model down? Because the county only deals with licensed providers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, generally, if that information is brought to our attention or if it's brought to the county's attention, there would be kind of a visit out there, try to assess the situation, determine whether they fit one of the exemptions or not. If they are providing care to multiple children in a home setting, they would be told that they need a license. If they don't immediately begin that process, then they would be told that they're engaged in providing unlicensed care. That is a misdemeanor under Minnesota. The county attorney can bring an injunction to close them down if they do not sort of immediately begin the process of getting a license. So the way our statute is written in the Human Services Act is it contemplates that they would be informed they need a license. We expect that they would very quickly begin that process. We would all be working to expedite and get that program into compliance as soon as possible. But the county attorney can, and they can be criminally cited and prosecuted. So you see up there the other things, emergency preparedness, although we have some basic things in statute and rules now, tornado, fire drills, the requirements under the block grant go much further. They require providers to have a plan related to what we might call sort of more man-made either disasters or these catastrophes that unfortunately are in our headlines. You know, there can be a domestic incident where they might evacuate a neighborhood, and a child care provider would need to have a plan for what if somebody shows up and says, you know, there's a threat two houses away, you've got to go. Many providers we know are doing this, but again, they're putting the standard and the requirement in place. For health and safety standards and training, the federal reauthorization calls out 12 different topic areas that all states must address and have standards in place for and have training requirements in place for. Minnesota, we are actually very close to being in compliance. We have many of these topics already covered. There's a few places that we need to make some tweaks, but we don't see this as being one that would be a major change from what we currently have in statute now. One of the other changes, though, is that if there hadn't been a training requirement in place on these topics and a unlicensed, legally non-licensed provider is participating in the subsidy program, then they would need to begin to take some additional training. And so, again, there are some parts, particularly the legal non-licensed participating in the subsidy program, that will be more impacted by these changes. Background study requirements. So one of the other big changes is that the background study requirements are in place for states to move to a FBI national background study check. One thing, when I talked about that we need to go to annual inspections, we are one of less than 10 states that hadn't already been doing it when the reauthorization occurred in 2014. Most states had already moved to annual inspections. Some states had up to two unannounced visits and were kind of having that level of regulation. So we were sort of an outlier, if you will, in terms of not having annual inspections compared to where other states were. Many states had already instituted fingerprint-based FBI national criminal checks for child care settings. We did not have that. We do have authority to do an FBI fingerprint check if we have a reasonable cause to do that. So we do have some authority now, but not across the board. So this would require us to institute checks of national registries, the National Sex Offender Registry, Child Abuse and Neglect Registries in any state that somebody has lived in for the last 5 years. Those are changes from what we have now. We do have, as you see on the chart, trying to explain back to Madam Chair, members of the committee, back to this chart that tries to give you that snapshot of, you know, who has a requirement now and how the federal reauthorization might change that. For legal non-licensed family providers, they have had to have a background study through the county as part of participating in the child care assistance program. License-exempt centers, that could be a school-based before or after-school program, or it could be the Y is running a before or after-school program. They could be participating in the subsidy program now. They are not currently under a requirement to have a background study either through the county or through DHS. Obviously, we know that many, if not all, of those providers are doing some of their own background studies, but this would be a change for them that they would now need to do the type of study that's required by the Federal Reauthorization Act. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'll just try to be mindful. I know you had a few people that you were hoping to get some testimony in. We do have timelines that are set forth in the Federal Reauthorization Act for when the state must be in compliance. There were many timelines that were required for September 30th of 2016. The state was able, all states were, to ask for some waivers, they were called, extensions to come into compliance. We have been able to do that for many. The background study is not required for compliance until September 30th of 2017, so we have some additional time to come into compliance on that. As the slide indicates, we did have a waiver. If we do not come fully into compliance, then there is the risk of penalties being assessed. Trying to get more information from the feds on what that means, but it is very clearly written into the reauthorization that there could be penalties that are assessed. And I think the last slide kind of also drives at home what we believe and what I think both the Children and Family Services and the Office of Inspector General, we do oversee the background studies as well as the licensing in the Office of Inspector General. We believe that the Reauthorization Act, you know, really does move the child care program more, as Assistant Commissioner Koppel said, into that early childhood focus. It does very deliberately begin to bring health and safety into that discussion about, you know, what can we guarantee for standards across all of our settings and how to ensure that there is eyes on for the annual inspections, eyes on in a setting at least once a year to ensure that kids are safe and that, quite honestly, technical assistance can be brought sooner. The posting requirement to make sure that information is available, some of that is currently out there. We have a website called Licensing Information Lookup that the public can go to. There will be some changes for our family child care providers through the county. We don't currently post all of that compliance information there, so we're working on some IT solutions to get that more available in with regards to the timelines for the fall. But by and large, it's a very significant shift. It's looking at child care maybe less as an immediate work support under the welfare to work frame of 1996 and more as what we know about early childhood, about early brain development, the crucial years of 0 to 3, and really trying to ensure that health and safety, standardized background studies are a part of ensuring that kids are in safe care.
All right. Thank you, Regina. We have some testifiers. Does anybody, any members have any questions for Ms. Wagner before I have public testimony? There's a list somewhere here, which I don't have. All right. So first up, we do have, that's not it. We have Jessica Anderson from the Children's Defense Fund. No? Mm-hmm.
First testimony of the session. I might be a little rusty. So I'm Jessica Anderson. I'm the Legislative Affairs. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and we're also a member of the Kids Can't Wait Child Care Coalition. And Claire Sanford with the Child Care Association was going to be here today testifying for that coalition, but cannot seem to get past Plymouth in the snow. So so she is not here, but we have a handout for that coalition. I'd just like to start by saying how exciting and heartening it is that child care is getting what we think is the attention it deserves, as demonstrated through the formation of this subcommittee. So thank you to all of you for serving on this important select group, and we look forward to working with you. CDF has been a longtime proponent of affordable, accessible, high-quality child care, and that's because we know it's a two-generation approach to family economic security. It helps parents to get to work and provide for their families while setting their children up for future success. And so I'll just very briefly share three of the policy priorities that we would like to see this committee support. Number one, as we've heard a lot about today, is the federal reauthorization. We support innovation and improvement within our child care system. And federal requirement aside, we believe this reauthorization contains very good policy that would, among other things, help to increase stability among families receiving CCAP and give children greater consistency in their care. The second priority is fully funding basic sliding fee child care assistance. As Chair Franson has aptly noted in the past, families can't afford to pay more for child care, but providers can't afford to charge less. And so that's why we at CDF believe that subsidies through CCAP have to be part of the solution. This is a vital program to thousands of children and families across the state, but funding has decreased in the past decade. And we now serve 2,000 fewer families in greater Minnesota and 1,700 fewer in the metro area as a result. We have a 5,000 family wait list as it is, and without new funding, fewer and fewer families will be served due to inflation. And then lastly, our third priority that we hope you'll join us in supporting is increasing CCAP provider reimbursement rates. As you know, the current rate doesn't cover the majority of provider prices in Minnesota, and increasing the rate could help providers to keep their doors open to CCAP families and expand families' choice of affordable providers in their area. So in conclusion, again, we look forward to working with each of you in advancing these and other priorities, and I probably speak for everyone here in saying we're a resource that's here for you, and we look forward to working together. Thank you.
All right. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Flanagan.
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Anderson, can you just state the number again? There's 2,000 fewer in greater Minnesota. And what was the number for the metro?
1,700 fewer in the metro area.
Okay.
And so that's since 2002. Funding has decreased by 28%. And so we're serving fewer and fewer families every year.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Representative Cagle. You didn't? All right. Well, does anybody else have any questions for Ms. Anderson? All right, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Elizabeth Bangert from Here We Go Grow. Ms. Bangert, please state your name for the record and you may proceed.
My name is Elizabeth Bangert. I'm the owner and director of Here We Grow Early Childhood Center in Mankato, and I also started doing consulting as well for other providers in our area who are trying to start up or revitalize their centers. I was at the meeting in Worthington, and I am very excited that this has come this far. In Minnesota, specifically relating to the block grant, child care assistance is very challenging for families. It's challenging for center providers. In Mankato, there are a lot of providers that actually do not take child care assistance. I myself find it challenging because we are a 4-star rated center, and there are 2 separate billing systems. While they used to align with each other, I bill biweekly for families and sometimes don't get paid by the county for 21, 30 days. And that already puts me 5 weeks behind. So this last year, when I had 50% of my enrollment that was utilizing child care assistance, because we attract families because of the grant program through Parent Aware, I had to take out a $20,000 line of credit so that I could borrow from the line of credit, pay interest on the line of credit until the county decided they would pay. Additionally, I work with 3 counties, Blue Earth, Le Sueur, and Nicollet County. Blue Earth County has done a lot lately. Nicollet County is very challenging to work with. I have families who just have actually chosen to leave Here We Grow now because they can't keep up with what Nicollet County is asking of them versus Blue Earth, where they came from, because their significant other serves as a coach and made $2,000 extra, for example. So now that knocks them out of the child care assistance program, so they don't want to just deal with the hassle of that one-time $2,000 amount. Or the cliff effect happens a lot. Families lose their assistance very rapidly, and they're not prepared financially because they just finished schooling. And so they either have to leave, or we now have both pathways because we are a 4-star center. But then what happens is I have to wait to bill that until the county bills. So those families who receive assistance, which was 10 out of our 38 families. Last year, I actually was 2 months behind on billing because I wait for the county to pay, and then I submit the balance, which worked really well last year, except now this year the state has changed it, so you have to pay either the 1st or the 15th of the month or the 1st or the 31st. Then I have to prorate it out. And if the county changes their payment and back charges a family because of their pay stub, then I have to fill out more paperwork for that. So I spent a lot of time doing my paperwork. And I'm really hoping maybe somehow those two systems can align. I enter when children are absent on the child care assistance program, and then I re-enter it into a separate form and bill that to the Rochester office. So I feel like I'm doing double the work on 2 of the same forms. Increments of pay, small increments of pay. I actually read through the 307-page block grant just to get an idea. So I'm hoping that some of the things can change, such as paying for hourly versus full-time or part-time care. That's very challenging for families to have a $3.27 an hour rate at 25 hours versus paying for half of our tuition. The use of electronic tools, one of my counties is still using paper, and that family happens to be a split family, so I have to wait for the father to return to turn in the paper forms, which only lengthens the process for receiving reimbursement from that county. Right now we're looking at increasing our rates in Mankato, and it's going to be fairly drastic because I need to retain the quality that we've established with Parent Aware 4-star rating. And now, much as the First Children's Finance had a slideshow presentation in July of 2016, that pretty much rings true to my current situation, where I have to increase rates between 11 and 15% in order to keep my staff, who are highly qualified, to retain that quality level of care and keep our 4-star parent-aware rating. So currently, rates in our area are about 175 to 195 for preschool, and ours will need to go up to 225 because I have 2 employees with a master's degree and the rest have bachelor's or associate's degree, and paying them $11 an hour is not going to cut it. Even in the outlying areas that I do try and help them establish centers, Mapleton is a consulting client of mine. Their town is struggling. Their child care center is currently closed right now, and because they're still part of Blue Earth County, while the child care reimbursement rate is high, they can't charge what Mankato can charge, even though it's 20 miles away. So I could go on for a long time, but I'm sure there's others who want to talk. So I'll be done.
Thank you very much. That was enlightening. Could you just remind us, you were talking about the two billing systems. What billing systems?
So when a family qualifies for child care assistance, I use the MEC system to bill. It's MEC Pro 2. When they qualify for that, and our currently one of the pathways, I think it's Pathway 2, has that's the grant for parent where that stays with the family. They had a waiting list in our region, so I applied for Pathway 1 through the Department of Education and was awarded $37,500, which stays with Here We Grow, but I can distribute to families to help with their co-payments, which that also has a separate billing form.
So Pathway 1 has a separate billing
form? Pathway 1, Pathway 2, and each fiscal year has a separate billing form, so I have 8 billing forms between the counties and Parent Aware grants. So what happens is because the county bills from a, their billing period runs from a Monday through the 2 weeks following Sunday, it's in 2 week billing periods. When they pay, then I have to enter that into the form to give the Parent Aware billing that says what the county paid and the difference, which used to work very seamlessly last year. This year, for the new fiscal year, they updated it, and they want you to do it either the 1st or the 15th or the 16th or the 31st. That never works. Mm-hmm. So I have literally a notebook where I handwrite down what I wrote and what I prorated it out to be, and then I go back and deduct that the next month times 12 children right now. Good thing I like math.
That's great. All right. Is that, yeah, no kidding. Anybody have any questions for Ms. Bangert? Well, we thank you for driving in this nasty weather. This Laura and I were discussing. It's a reminder of when we were in your area and we had to drive back in that snowstorm. That was interesting. So be safe. Next up, we have Dan Gumnett from People Serving People.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Dan. Please state your name for the record.
Sure. For the record, my name is Daniel Gumnett, and I'm the CEO of People Serving People, and we're the region's or the state's largest shelter for children and their families experiencing homelessness. I'm here specifically to talk about the challenges that homeless families face. Every day I see the struggle that parents living with homelessness face. I know that connecting parents with access to child care is essential to allowing them and their children to break the cycle of homelessness. By passing the federal conformity, particularly the expedited application and activity exemption portion, funding CCAP, raising reimbursement rates, we can help our state's most vulnerable children make real gains to close the achievement gap, set themselves up for future success. We can also help their parents. They would have the peace of mind that their children are receiving high-quality care while they seek and keep employment to support their families. Passing federal conformity, particularly the expedited application and activity exemption, funding CCAP, raising reimbursement rates, these are two generational approaches and solutions that close the achievement gap, help parents find and keep employment, reduce the looming workforce shortage, and help families break the cycle of poverty and homelessness.
All right. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Gumnett? Is it Gumnett?
Gumnett, yes, ma'am.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Any questions? All right, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you for allowing me to
And I'm sure my office is open if you are wanting to come in and talk some more, okay?
I'd love to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is anybody from the audience wishing to testify? All right. Well, seeing none, we will continue this in-depth conversation next Wednesday at 8:15 in the morning. And I have told Representative Peterson, Vice Chair Peterson, that if she comes in again with Starbucks, she has to bring us some as well.
Treats.
And then also to just to the department here, could you please break us down even more, like how much this is going to cost, what we have received from
the federal government for the child care block grant reauthorization, any dollars received, as well as how many licensors are probably going to FTEs, altogether FTEs, and break those FTEs down to what their roles will be. Am I missing anything else, members? Representative Albright. Oh, you don't have a question? Okay, so if you could bring down those fiscal impacts to the state and to the taxpayers, that would be amazing. And with that, we are adjourned. I want to thank everybody for